This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're off to a birthday party in Highland Park. The party is down a side street off the neighborhood's busy Figueroa Corridor. It is a house on a corner in a cluster of historic craftsman homes, some with a fresh coat of paint, some showing their age. Where a group of roommates are celebrating one of their birthdays. Everyone's around a dining table in the kitchen. There are plenty of candles and the strawberry shortcake. It's kind of what you'd expect, except for one little thing. Pat, our birthday boy, has 24 roommates. Yeah, you heard right. We've been talking a lot about LA's increasingly unaffordable housing. The city, of course, is trying to come up with solutions, but in the meantime, a lot of Angelenos have had to find their own. One of Pat's roommates is a guy named Andres. He was living out of his car before he moved in here. He points out that a lot of people under one roof is getting more common as the rents go up.
Community living and housing isn't a new or novel concept. Immigrants have done it in LA for a long time. And I know a lot of people who grew up with a family of 15 in a single room. And these things are born out of necessity. And I think what they really highlight is a larger issue in society right now, which is a housing crisis.
And yeah, it sounds like a sitcom.
This is the true story. True story.
Of seven strangers picked to live in a loft
and have their lives taped
to find out what happens
when people stop being polite
and start getting real.
The real world.
Except this is the real world times three. KCRW's Kaylee Wells visited this home come hostel and explores what life is like under one crowded roof.
It's a one-story, 2,000-square-foot house with five bedrooms. It might be full, but it stays pretty clean. Luckily, there's enough room for two kitchens, but get this, only two bathrooms. Also, a bunch of characters.
So, will you start by introducing yourself?
Susan Morgan, basically a server, waitress, caterer, musician, actor, writer, stereotype, basically everybody in LA. Hi.
My name is Ben Olson. I'm like a musician and then I do film stuff, so it's kind of the
Ben's from Portland. There's Helen Harlan.
I'm an event bartender and server. I have been trying to be a writer and actor for 17 years.
My name is Noah Lani. I just graduated college. I want to be a sex researcher.
I'm Justin, 21, going on 22 this year.
Justin ran away from home when he was 18. He works at PetSmart.
I'm looking to find some full-time work before school starts, hopefully this fall.
There's a Muslim community college student who hasn't told her parents about how many people she lives with. There's Andy, the house manager, basically like a college RA who handles any home drama. There's Travis, the laundry-delivering, dog-sitting, aspirational screenwriter. And that's only a third of the tenants.
Silence. Weird. In-house.
What'd you say?
The roommates range from 19 years old to 52, but most of them are in their 20s, single. Many of them are aspiring artists. About two-thirds of them are white. It's a quirky group, and the crowd is always changing. Two to four people move in and out every month. And the one thing they have in common? The less than $600 price tag on Craigslist caught their attention. Each of them pays $580 a month in rent. And here's what that gets you. A bunk. Yes, a bunk bed. A wardrobe. A cubby in the kitchen for dry food, and a corner of the fridge. Utilities and Wi-Fi, maid service twice a week, and staples like light bulbs and paper towels and toilet paper. Walking around, there's not a lot of free space. Every corner is taken up by a chair or a set of shelves or a fridge.
We have one, two, three, four refrigerators in the big kitchen.
That's Helen again.
The sink looks pretty clean, but it looks like there's a lot kind of stacked up in the drying racks. I mean, is this sort of a typical amount of...
It's a weekly battle here about the dishes, but that's just, like I say, there's just certain compromises you have to make when you live in a situation like this.
Compromises like sacrificing the coveted bottom bunk and all of its storage underneath, keeping bathroom time to a minimum, accepting that if you put something in a communal space, it's for communal use. And it's hard to enter a communal room without another sign that the house is filled with aspiring artists.
I feel like I've seen at least 5 guitars.
Oh, yeah. There's probably more.
25 people sharing 2 bathrooms sounds terrible. But even on a Wednesday night or a Sunday afternoon, it's pretty quiet here because people are working in the gig economy and their hours are all over the place. Helen says that makes sharing a space a lot easier.
Everybody thinks that they're like, how can that work? But it does.
Not only does it work, but 6 people to a bedroom? That's legal. LA's Department of Building and Safety told me you could sleep 100 people in a room if you wanted. There's no cap within city limits. As long as everyone's in bedrooms, as long as you're not putting mattresses in places designed to be kitchens and living rooms, it's allowed. Well, it might be legal, but some of the neighbors aren't thrilled to have so many people living in the house on the corner. One called a housing inspector, and they complained that with half of the roommates owning cars, it makes street parking a hassle. It all serves as a reminder that Highland Park, like many LA neighborhoods, has gotten a whole lot more expensive and a whole lot whiter. Here's Noah Lani.
Gentrification is a huge issue, and I thought about that before moving here.
Ben says he feels guilty, but doesn't feel like he has a choice.
I shouldn't be here. I mean, like, I'm absolutely part of the problem. I don't know what to do. I'm trying to find something affordable.
But Justin says if it's bringing people into the neighborhood that couldn't otherwise afford it, isn't that more inclusive?
It is very cheap to live here. It's $580 for this house. It's good to live here. And with that price point, there's so much access to different people at different levels to be able to come here and live here. And we make it a comfortable place for everybody. And I think that makes it more acceptable of anybody.
But most of them wouldn't call this a solution to the housing crisis. They use words like a reaction or a coping mechanism to get through the housing crisis. Ben called it a Band-Aid solution.
It fixes part of the problem, but I think overall it's going to take more systemic changes, more just the government. It's a bigger thing than just like a couple houses that can hold 25 people is going to solve.
Susan says the more popular this model gets, the less of a Band-Aid solution it'll become.
There might be like a cause and effect where people see dollar signs and then these start popping up everywhere.
Susan says she's already seen other communal houses pop up for more, $750 a month. One in the valley she looked at asked for $1,000. The rent may be cheaper than getting a studio on your own, but for the landlord, it really adds up. At this house in Highland Park, the owner leases to one tenant. He calls himself the property manager. He then subleases to the 25 people living there. When the house is full, that means the property manager is pulling in nearly $14,000 every month for a 2,000-square-foot house that Zillow estimates would normally rent for $3,200. And rent control doesn't apply to, quote, single-family homes. Susan worries that with prices escalating so fast, her roommates, who see living here as a stopgap, may find they can't afford to move out.
And people think this is a new normal, and it should be, at the end of the day, like, kind of temporary.
That's how most of the tenants view this. Temporary. Just until they can get the part or land that gig or publish that album. Most haven't been there for more than a year. But in that in-between time, Justin says it feels like home.
As many quirks as everyone has, they're my friends, and I love spending time with them. I know when I come home, I will have a place to be, comfortable and safe, and in the midst of, like, smiling faces. It means the world to me.
For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
When you're on a holiday, you can't find the words to say. All the things that come to you.
It's nice they got all the instruments out. What odd things are you doing to make your rent cheaper? How many roommates do you have? How do you get by? Tweet at me, would you? At Radio Chio and hashtag it Greater LA. Well, coming up, for more than a decade, a South LA farm has been barren. Will it ever grow again? The latest on that fight on that plot of land. You're listening to Greater LA right here on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It was once one of the biggest urban farms in the country, around 14 acres of fruit trees and vegetable gardens in South Central Los Angeles, tended to by hundreds of families. What was once known as the South Central Farm turned into a swath of land where farmers and activists got evicted. After more than a decade of legal wrangling, an LA City Council vote last night may have sealed its fate. And Emily Alpert-Reyes covers City Hall for the LA Times, and she's with us right now from City Hall. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm all right. Where exactly is this plot of land?
So this is in kind of an industrial area of South LA right near Vernon, along Alameda near 40 and 41st Street.
So this is like southeast of downtown Los Angeles?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about this farm. I mean, it was one of those neighborhood farms where a lot of locals have their own little plots, right?
Yeah, this is a plot of land with an interesting history. The city had obtained this land through eminent domain to build a trash incinerator. It ended up junking that plan after there was a lot of community opposition, and residents started using it to grow their own fruits and vegetables. Eventually, though, the land ended up back in the hands of its former owner, and after kind of a tumultuous back and forth, he refused to sell it to the farmers, which led to them being evicted from that land.
So they got evicted. I know this was more than a decade ago that that happened, and it was a pretty, I would say, colorful moment in L.A. history. A lot of people went over there and tried to really keep that plot of land for these farmers.
Yeah, there were celebrities there. There were people, you know, chaining themselves to trees and to concrete drums, and, you know, Daryl Hannah was there in a walnut tree and was one of the last people kind of removed from the property. I think there's a documentary about it as well.
I know there are plots of land like this all around the Southland where people farm, like community farms. What's been happening there since they were evicted? Has that land just sat empty?
Basically, there were plans at one point to build a Forever 21 warehouse and distribution center. Those stalled. Eventually, the site was sold to a company called Pima Alameda Partners, which got city approval to build an industrial park for garment manufacturing. And then the farmers sued to try to stop those plans.
So what about the vote yesterday at L.A. City Council? What did that do? How did that seal its fate?
Well, last year, the farmers had gotten a ruling that they were excited about. A judge had said the city needed to do more analysis on how the planned warehouse development would affect traffic. So the city, I mean, basically did that analysis, came back, and approved the environmental review for the project again, which should allow it to move forward.
So can there be any appeals moving forward? Can there be another injunction, legal wrangling that can happen in the future with this piece of land?
The attorney for the farmers has said that there could be some steps they could try to take to continue the fight in the next couple of months. They could also just file a new lawsuit. But this does seem to be kind of a key step in the city, you know, reapproving this project that would, you know, essentially block out hopes for reestablishing the farm on that land.
And there really are two sides to this. I mean, obviously, there are two sides or many sides to this issue. But the one thing that I noticed was a lot of people are saying, hey, this is a piece of land where if things go there, like some sort of commercial business, people can be put to work in the community instead of just farming.
Right. I mean, so the backers of this project say, look, this is an area that really needs economic development. This project is going to provide jobs. One person I talked to with the Concerned Citizens of South Central Los Angeles basically said, you know, this is an industrial area. This is not really an appropriate area for farming at all. The farmers and their supporters in turn say, well, it was before, it could be again, and it could provide you know, local produce and a different kind of model of supporting locals.
So this is that certain piece of land. Maybe it's not appropriate for farming. Maybe it is. Are they looking at other plots of land perhaps to do this somewhere else?
One of the farm organizers said, you know, they would certainly be interested in other spaces. This one is one that I think was both, you know, that they had a lot of attachment to for historical reasons and because of just the sheer size of it. It's hard to find, a plot that is quite that big. But no, I think they have expressed that they would be interested in potentially trying to do this somewhere else.
Obviously, the whole idea of food deserts and trying to get more fresh produce, more fresh food in that area will be ongoing. Emily Albert-Reyes, who covers City Hall for the LA Times. Emily, thanks.
Thank you.
You can listen to us online, by the way, at any time, kcrw.com/GreaterLA, or by podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Just ahead, finding renewal in the ooze. Some exciting news, some exciting things happening at the La Brea Tar Pits just in time for the 4th. That's next on KCRW's Greater LA. It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. So here's a question for you. You sticking around LA this holiday weekend? Well, apart from the fireworks and the parades, there certainly is a lot of fun stuff to do around the city that is not so red, white, and blue. And KCRW's design and architecture expert, Frances Anderton, is here to talk about it with one idea. Hello, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
So what do you have for us?
Well, something that you could say is violet, yellow, orange, red. We're talking about the Second Home Serpentine Pavilion. This is a pop-up installation. It's just gone on show at La Brea Tar Pits. You can find it quite close to the Japanese Pavilion.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's actually went up in the UK in 2015. It was designed by a very cool architecture firm called Selgas Kano out of Madrid. They're getting quite a lot of work in LA. They've been quite sought after. They absolutely love plastic, this office. And what they've made is a very trippy plastic pavilion. Imagine two tubes that you can stand up in. They're kind of slug-like. They've got very sort of weavy, windy walls, and they weave around and they crisscross in the middle, tall enough for you to hang out in that middle. And it's, you know, you could call it a selfie opportunity. You can certainly call it an opportunity to see the work of these architects from Madrid who are coming to LA. They're particularly going to be getting a lot of attention later this fall. They're designing something called Second Home, which is a very interesting shared workspace plus kind of culture center. Selgas Kano are the designers. We'll be talking more about that later in the fall, but this is a venue where you can get a taste of their work.
But why among the mastodons over at the LA Tar Pits, the La Brea Tar Pits?
Good call there, Steve. And we might add that the mastodons are, you know, caught up in that primordial ooze, which of course is tar. And in a nice kind of twist, I guess, this pavilion happens to be made of plastic. But yes, you wouldn't typically expect to go to the La Brea Tar Pits, which occupy one half of the site that LACMA occupies, the big park. You'd expect to find this kind of thing. It is an art installation, essentially. You'd expect to find it more at the LACMA side of the site. Well, the Natural History Museums of LA County, which owns the Tar Pits, is embarking on a big kind of rethink about how they are perceived in the city, repositioning themselves, rethinking their site, their mission. Just listen to Laurie Bateson-Varga. She's head of the Natural History Museums.
So this one really is about how we can bring together art, science, experience, place into this location with this museum. And think about how to make this seem like more of a destination and campus with all of the different opportunities for culture and science and art here.
So they've invited three quite high-profile design teams to come up with master planning strategies for this site. In August, these will be revealed and the public will be invited to come observe and comment on them. Meanwhile, you could say they've signaled this expanded kind of art, science, cultural footprint that they want to make with this pop-up pavilion.
You mentioned a master plan, and this is a part of sort of the LACMA territory as well. LACMA's already getting a big facelift and new building and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, I was curious about the same thing. There is a big overhaul happening at LACMA. We're soon to see four buildings start demolition. They are going to be replaced by this single building that's going over the site, that's going over Wilshire Boulevard, designed by Swiss architect Peter Zumthor, who is himself master planning that part of the site and who himself drew inspiration for his initial amoebic black monolithic elevated blob that was his first that was his first pass on the design. He drew inspiration from the tar pits. It actually went too close to the tar pits. The folks that run the tar pits weren't so happy about that. The building was sort of pushed over Wilshire. But as I say, ironic that he really was inspired by the black bubbling ooze. So anyway, no, the folks that run the tar pits have chosen to go in their own direction with their own set of designers. Bates and Varga told me that they want a different approach. She says also that they're not necessarily focused on creating a building. They'll probably be thinking quite a lot about the landscaping and basically how you landscape around fossils and mastodons.
So how does the Serpentine Pavilion fit into all of this, Frances?
Well, again, it does represent this fusion of art and science, which is very much something that the La Brea Tar Pits hopes to really kind of make explicit in its future development. And there is a kind of timeliness about it. It so happens that the Getty just announced its next Pacific Standard Time show. It's going to take place in 2024. And the topic this time around is going to be the intersection of art and science. So the Tar Pits will inevitably be part of that big show, along with many other museums and galleries in LA. So this is a nice, you know, first footprint in the tar, as it were.
And between now and 2024, I suspect there are going to be a lot of changes over at the tar pits, right?
Yes, although LACMA's master planning and new building has been in process for literally years. Mm-hmm. So these processes can take a long time, but definitely people should keep an ear out for mid-August when they'll be able to get a first taste of what the three design teams are presenting for the tar pit site. And I'll just add, one of the design teams is Dilla Scofidio Renfro, which designed the Broad in downtown, just FYI.
All right, so maybe another cheese grater there.
Or maybe something equally symbolic but more appropriate to its site. What about for the West Side, a julienne slicer, Steve?
Frances Anderton, KCRW's Design and Architecture, which, by the way, you can hear Tuesdays at 1:30 right here on KCRW. Frances, thanks.
You're very welcome, Steve.
Cheese grater is good for pasta, by the way, for lunch. I hope you had lunch already. Hey, no matter what your plans are, you should be dry for the 4th of July, although you might have to dodge some clouds, which could obstruct your nighttime fireworks. So bear that in mind if you're going to seek some fireworks tomorrow night. Clouds, then sunshine throughout greater LA. Low 70s near the beaches, low 100s in the Antelope Valley and the high desert as well. So about 102 in Palm Springs, 2 in the desert. So if you're headed out there, get ready for hot. That is our show for today. Tomorrow, just in time for the holiday, Patriots at Pasadena's Jet Propulsion Laboratory are watching Mars and digging into that red planet. And what a story the woman who oversees that mission has. It is very American. You also know about mansions and McMansions across greater LA. How about Giga Mansions, the behemoth homes marketed to billionaires? But are they selling? Coming up next on KCRW, it's all the president's lawyers. Our producer is Catherine Barnes. Our editor is Sonia Geis. Phil Richards and Ray Guarna help engineer and mix this show each and every day. Christian Bordahl runs the operation. I'm Steve Chiatakis. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. You can check out the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Greater LA and KCRW. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your ear. I hope you have a safe holiday. We'll be back tomorrow right here on KCRW.